Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Crime and Science Radio. Today is going to be a little bit on the flip side as Doug Lyle gets put into the hot seat and being interviewed by Hank Philippi Ryan. 2 weeks ago, Hank interviewed Jan Burke, and now we're flipping it back on Doug. So you get to hear both of the hosts now being interviewed by Hank Philippi Ryan. So let's jump right in right now with no further ado, and here we go. Hank Philippi Ryan interviewing the host of Crime and Science Radio, or one of the co-hosts, Doug Lyle.
I'm Hank Philippi Ryan, and we're turning the tables a bit today. Dr. Doug Lyle, one of your hosts here on Crime and Science Radio, today is in the interviewee seat. So, Doug, are you ready? You've been asking people questions, you and Jan Burke, for so many wonderful months now for your show, and we just couldn't wait to ask you some questions.
Well, I'm ready. I'm terrified with you interviewing me. You're such an investigating reporter.
Well, I've been a reporter for 40 years, but I'm not going to ask you the good questions. It's so amazing because so many of us authors have relied on you and your incredible expertise. You're so generous with your time and your knowledge. We thought it was about time for you to talk about yourself a little bit, how your mind works and how you think and how you manage to juggle so many fascinating parts of your life. So welcome, Doug, to your very own show.
Thanks for having me here.
So tell us, where did you grow up? What were you like as a kid?
Annoying. I grew up in Huntsville, Alabama. I have two sisters, and a mom and a dad, and the typical, lower middle class family. Dad worked at the post office. Mom was a bookkeeper for a dairy. And as a kid, I just did all the usual stuff you did. I went to school and played sports and tried to not to annoy my mother too much.
Yeah. I grew up in really rural Indiana, so rural that you couldn't see another house from our house. And I spent a lot of time reading. Did you read as a kid? What did you read? What did you do?
Actually, not as a young kid, because I was involved in sports and school and all that stuff. But when I was about 14, I ended up at the library waiting for my dad to pick me up after a rainy day in football practice, and I picked up a book of Jules Verne. It happened to be It Turned to the Center of the Earth, and that's the really first, quote, real book, that I'd ever read. I was 14, as I said, and it absolutely blew me away. So I devoured everything I could find by Jules Verne after that, and then moved on to Edgar Rice Burroughs, and from there ended up with Hemingway and Steinbeck. So my reading probably started at about age 14. Before that, it was comic books and stupid things.
Well, no, comic books. We love comic books. I remember sitting in the back of our station wagon reading Superman, and my mom would say, "Look out the window, participate." And I'm like, "I'm reading, Mom. I'm reading Superman." But that's cool. That was... The space race was underway then. Were you involved in science back then?
Well, only out of interest. My dad had nothing to do with the space program, but we had so many people that we knew that were heavily involved, and my parents were close friends of the Von Brauns, went dancing with them and stuff like that. And my older sister, her best friend was one of Von Braun's right-hand man's daughters. So, I mean, you could not grow up in Huntsville, Alabama in the 50s and 60s and not know the space program. It just permeated everything because the Marshall Space Flight Center was there and Von Braun and all his people were there. So you could – I was school with the kids of all these German scientists. They were very smart kids.
That's historic and somewhat chilling, to think of what came from that. Again, this is a wonderful story that you're telling. I didn't realize this about your childhood. And you sort of think in the South, everybody's a storyteller. You kind of have to know how to tell a story if you live in the South. Was that your environment as well?
Oh, sure. I've always said that growing up in the South, if you can't tell a story, they won't feed you. They'll think there's something wrong. put you out behind the barn and let you wither away. But the point is that that is a Southern tradition. I think it comes from the old, you know, Scotch-Irish that were always known for telling stories. And most of that, those people who immigrated to the U.S. settled through Appalachia. Well, as the Appalachian chain dwindles, it kind of dies right around North Alabama, around Huntsville. The city's kind of wrapped around Montezuma Mountain, which is one of the last little bumps of the Appalachian chain. So that storytelling tradition lived deeply there. When we would sit around the dinner table and have conversations, it wasn't just, you know, what you do in school today, oh, not much. No, there was a story, and it had characters and dialogue and setting and backstory and, you know, the B and C plot lines, you named it. Yeah, we didn't know it at the time. We were just telling a story about what happened, but it was always colorful. And I was just, my mother was a great storyteller. She never let the truth get in the way of a great story.
Exactly, and that's why you can turn to fiction. I mean, it's
exactly.
Interesting because you learn the rhythm of a story, and you learn about suspense, and you learn about the big finish.
Right.
You know, that's the kind of thing that gets ingrained. I mean, Tess Garrison always talks about how kids sort of self-select at a, I mean, a lot of her friends self-selected at a, you know, as a teenager to be a storyteller, to know that they wanted to write.
Sure.
Did you do that, or did your family encourage you in medicine? You went to medical school instead of writing.
Yeah, I knew very early on that I was going to go to medical school. I did have a little brief flirtation with orthodontics when I wore braces for a couple of years. I thought that was fascinating what they did. But in general, I mean, I decided at age 10 what I was going to do, and not only that I was going into medicine, but that I was going to go into the heart business. It just fascinated me. So I always knew that. So consequently, all of my interests from the time I was a kid was for science. So I never did much writing. But I could always tell a story, and I always wanted to tell stories. I always wanted to write. I always had a great love of books. I think books are special things. Always have. But about, 20 years ago, I always said that when I retired that I would see if I could write these stories that I had in my head. But I decided about 20 years ago, if not now, when, because I didn't see retirement anywhere. I'm not going to give up this job. I'm still practicing. I love it. But I took some classes at University of California, Irvine, and then just started writing. And, that's how it starts.
And we're going to talk about all your fiction and your nonfiction. But what's fascinating to me, one thing about your cardiology, is a person who's a cardiologist, that showed me that you like to understand how things work. I mean, we know how the heart works and almost why things happen the way they do. And it's, it so beautifully grows your cardiology that, sort of medically and then psychologically and forensically, you can see how your brain blossoms into using those things that you love, science, to and storytelling. It
sure.
just went together.
Yeah, it did, and like I said, you learn medicine by apprenticeship. You hang around people who know more than you, and you absorb what they're offering, what they're doing. You see what they're doing. Writing's the same way. You learn by apprenticeship. The apprenticeship is the library and the bookstore, and then later going to conferences and listening to other writers talk about how they do things. But basically, it's read, 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 write, 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 as you well know. And writers have to read. I mean, how do you learn? Where do you get your information? How do you learn how to tell a story? You have to learn how other people tell a story, and some of that will seep into yours. Some of it you will reject as, that's not me. So what? You have to learn that.
It's fascinating. I want to talk about how you evolved from newbie writer to teacher. You become, in medicine, what is it? See one, do one, teach one?
See one, do one, teach one, right.
And it's sort of the same evolution in being an author. You read, 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 and
sure.
write, 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 and learn, learn, learn. And at some point, you evolve and you realize, gosh, I sort of, as much as anybody knows what they could be doing at any point in time, I know what I'm doing. I mean, your mainstream audience book, The Forensics for Dummies, was that the first of your nonfictions?
No, actually, the first one was a question and answer book called Murder and Mayhem back in like 2003. where I'd received all these questions you talked about earlier from writers. You know, I have this scenario. I want to know, does this make sense? How would I make this work? How can I use this in my story? Is this true? What would a body look like, you know, under this circumstance? How does this poison work? That kind of thing. So I would...
I mean, this you call the morbidly curious author.
Exactly. You know? I mean, authors, you know, especially crime fiction writers, as you well know, are a strange lot. I mean, there's so much psychopathology among this group. It's scary. But they come up with incredible ways of offing people, an incredible way of configuring stories. I'm always fascinated by it. I've always been... I learned as much from the questions as I hope they do from the answers.
Oh, that's dope. I mean, I remember my husband and I were at dinner at a restaurant a couple of months ago, and I said to him, just sort of musing, you know, honey, you couldn't really throw someone off a bridge if you wanted to kill them, because that you couldn't necessarily confirm that they would be dead when they hit the water.
Exactly.
And my husband says, and the waiter is like, ma'am, you know.
And when were you planning on doing this?
Exactly. We've all been overheard. So what inspired you to make a book of questions?
Well, like I said, I've gotten all these questions, and I had them all there, and I thought, you know, this is fascinating stuff. You know, how writers' minds work, how they plot their stories, how they come up with these little slices and how they're going to fit them in their story. And I thought, you know, this would be something to share. This would be something that everyone would be interested in. So actually, I called my agent, Kimberly Cameron, and I said, I got a great book here that I put together, and you're going to love it. And she said, what's it about? I said, I'm not going to tell you. I'm just going to send it to you. And she laughed, and she said, send it. So back then, you packaged everything up and mailed it. Yeah, not like now.
Yeah.
So I sent it to her, and she called me a few days later. She said, this is fantastic. I said, well, run with it. She sold it to St. Martin's in less than a week. Because it was extremely unusual. But I think if people read those three question answer books, they actually get a little insight into how writers think.
You know, one of the things that's so fascinating about those questions is that we write fiction, fiction, fiction. We're spinning a story, and then we get to a certain point, though, that it's necessary for the information to be correct, that
right.
The authors you work with care about, that at that moment of a forensic turning point or an investigation or a detective finding a clue or seeing a person who's been killed or not, that it has to be right. What is it that you think about that, that there's a moment that the writer realizes this had better be true and I better find out something?
Yeah, and good writers do that. Others, you know, just write the story and don't worry about the details. And I think if you're writing humor and parody and, you know, wild, crazy stuff, you can obviously bend the rules like crazy. But if you're writing crime fiction, you're writing for an extremely sophisticated audience. Crime readers are very smart. They know forensic science. They know how crime works. They know how investigations work because they follow it in the newspapers and on television and forensic files, you know, the real stuff. So if you butcher it, you're going to lose credibility with this group that are your readers very quickly. But I'm also quick to say is just remember that the story is not about the science. The story is about the characters. The science is what either pressures them and moves them in a direction of life out of balance, or it helps them get life back in balance by solving the question that the story raises. But it's not about the science. If you start getting into that, and as the physicians writing, I mean, I ran into the same thing. You know, we're very linear thinkers, and stories are messy. And just remember, you're not trying to educate. You're trying to entertain. But you better make the science right, or you lose that entertainment value because people start not trusting you.
Or you start, when you see the research being dumped into the story. And
right,
you
exactly.
See the tension. So you're saying don't rely on the science for your story. But
well, it's part of the story is the milieu, but don't make the story about the science. Like I got this cool scientific thing and I'm going to write this story and I'm going to preach about it. Back away. It's a story about a person that something bad happens to and they have to correct this badness, whatever it is. The cop trying to find a killer, is somebody trying to, you know, get out of a bad relationship, if somebody trying to get a date to the prom, whatever the story is about is a problem, they're trying to fix it. If there's science behind it, involved in the story, that's great. That's another level of interest and fun. But the story's not about the cool science. It's about
questions you get that you get, do they ever worry you? Have you ever written back and all that and said, I don't think you want to be asking about that?
What I do is I do require people to give me their contact information, their address, their phone number, their email, all that stuff. I require all that before I answer questions. It's kind of a soft filter, but it's a filter of sorts. But sometimes you'll get questions and you can realize they're about a real life situation. Somebody's relative was charged with murder, but they don't think they did it, but the police are out to get them. I'm sorry, I don't get involved in that. I can't answer that question. If you have a question about a story, I'll talk to you, but I'm not going to get into real life stuff.
Yes, and you intuitively can know from your experience which ones are from real authors and which ones are trying to get evidence.
Yeah, often you do. And I used to ask them back. I used to answer back saying, there's a lot of possible answers here. Can you give me the story context of your question? And a lot of them I won't hear back from again, but others I do. They say, it's about this story, about that. Yeah, okay, that makes sense. Now I can answer it in the story framework.
Do you work all the time, Doug? How do you do all these things?
We have a cat. his name's Zabine, and he's a Bengal. And if anybody knows anything about Bengals, they are noisy and nocturnal. So Zabine shows up about 4:30 every morning, ready for his day to start. So we just get up and get to work. But,
so you have a feline alarm clock, huh?
Exactly. I've never needed much sleep, and that's just the way I was. 5 hours is plenty. In fact, I find sleep a colossal waste of time. I think there's so much we could do if we didn't have to sleep. And I don't understand why we haven't evolved it out of our species, because it's a vulnerable time period. If you're living back in a cave, going to sleep can be deadly. Why we didn't evolve that need out, I don't understand. But
that is fascinating. Well, no wonder you can jiggle so many plates at the same time. I mean, I kept thinking that you, with all you could spot the perfect murder. I mean, you know how everything works. Would there be such a thing?
No.
As the perfect murder?
Yeah. No, there's not. A lot of people have thought they did, from Scott Peterson to O.J. to you name it. But the problem is that Mother Nature and Scott Peterson's case will spit the bodies out and bite you in the butt. And in O.J.'s case, citizens will screw up. In that case, a dog will screw up the perfect murder. He was supposed to be in Chicago by the time the bodies were found whole by the children. But the dog got out and started walking down the street covered with blood, so they found the murder scene within, less than an hour after it happened. Changed everything. So citizens and bad luck and Mother Nature, and it doesn't matter how smart you are, you're gonna miss 9 things. It's just the way it works. Now, whether the investigators find it or not, it's another story, but you just can't. Probably the closest thing is a sniper. One shot, one time, someone you don't know from long range, the only evidence you left is the bullet. If you destroy the weapons after and never, ever, ever say anything to anybody, you might get away with it. But then the point is why would you do it? Snipers are usually making a statement, political, social, anger at some group, whatever. So they're going to do it over and over and over again, and I just don't do it once. People just don't kill strangers for no reason.
And that's so interesting, because it shows you, the same as in writing fiction, it's all about motivation. It's all
sure.
about the reason for something.
Well, police, when they solve crimes, use a very simple formula: how plus why equals who. And the how is the MO, what weapon, what time of day, what location, and how'd they get there, how'd they get away, what was their alibi, all the stuff that goes into the MO of the crime. But the why is the motive. And that's always what catches people, because there's always a reason. Sometimes it's an insane reason, sometimes it's hard to figure out, but at the end of the day, there is a reason. Even serial killers have a reason. It's insane, but it works for them. Like in the fiction, the villains are the heroes of their own stories. They think they're right. They do what they do because that's what they do. They believe in that. We may think they're insane. But murder's a long way. And police always look for who stands to gain by this event.
And then it's the forensics that clinches the deal.
That helps. What forensics actually does, forensic science actually does, is point the finger away from everyone else and leaves one man standing, basically.
Do you still get chills when you think about that? One of the things that's the beauty of science and that is that parts of it are reliable, parts of it are dependable, parts that are just, you can, you know that this is how it works. How do you think about that compared to human behavior, which is unpredictable?
Well, I mean, it's interesting because right now, forensic science is undergoing a great renaissance, if you want to look at it one way, or a horrific attack, if you want to look at it another way. And it could be both, and I hope it's a renaissance, so to speak. None of the things that we use have ever really been rigorously scientific tested. They haven't gone through scientific scrutiny like everything else, even
fingerprints. You mean like fingerprints?
Yeah, no one's ever really done a study where they did, you know, 200 million people and objectively looked and everybody had different fingerprints. Well, yeah, but by the way, there's been hundreds of millions of fingerprints taken and no one's ever found two that were identical. So we feel pretty firm on that. The same way with DNA. Even now, identical twins, we have ways of separating them from one another with a DNA analysis. For a long time, we thought they were identical and couldn't be distinguished, but actually they can. But that's never really been tested. And things like bite marks and hair and fiber and all this. And the problem is the standardization and reproducibility of the science, and that the science is used the same way in every lab around the world, and then the reliability, qualifications, and training of the people who are doing it. And then lastly, are these people honest? Will they dry lab it, which means just make up the results? And in all three arenas, there are problems. But NIST, the National Institute of Standards and Technology, something like that. I get these acronyms mixed up all the time. But that's kind of, what they're doing is now starting a pilot program to try to standardize all of forensic science testing and reporting and qualifications for the people doing it. So if you're in New Jersey or you're in Utah, you're going to have the same test done by the same qualified people and have the same result. And that's critical. That's critical. But that's where we stand right now, forensic science. What's that?
Well, the field of forensics is so constantly changing, though, the science and the knowledge and the tools and the techniques. Are you constantly researching, or are there answers that you gave, you know, 10 years ago that would be different now?
Oh, sure. I mean, probably the biggest change has been in the arena of DNA. If you look at, you know, with touch DNA, where they can just take a fingerprint, well, a fingerprint's made of grime and oils and old dead cells from your finger. When you touch something and leave a fingerprint behind, you leave behind your cellular material, which means you leave behind your DNA. You not only that, you leave behind the chemicals that are in your body. So they can take a fingerprint now and not only get the pattern of the fingerprint, they can often extract DNA from that fingerprint, and they can do a toxicological profile to find out if you've used or handled cocaine, marijuana, GHB, other drugs. So, you know, wow.
Wow, is that
didn't exist,
good,
you know, a decade or so ago.
Good for law enforcement, but bad for crime fiction authors. You know,
exactly.
More difficult to prevent someone from being caught in a fiction, in a novel.
Exactly. And you have to know about all that. I mean, even if you're writing cozies, you have to at least have a general awareness of what forensic science is there. Otherwise, you know, your sleuth looks stupid. Even though they're not in the business, you want them to at least be aware. You want them to be not clueless wandering around and make stupid mistakes.
Or at least you can have someone in your novel who does know.
Sure. Well, I see it on TV all the time. People break into something and they're not wearing gloves, they're not covering their tracks, they're not doing anything. You're thinking, really? You know, this is 2015. Don't you know that you cover your hands and not leave fingerprints on doorknobs and cabinets and stuff like that?
I would love to watch TV with you. That would be great. My husband is a criminal defense attorney, and he yells at the television all the time when somebody does something wrong in the courtroom. And of course, I'm a reporter, and I'd be saying things like, "They don't have a wire. There's nothing connecting that to the electricity. How does that even work?" When you consult for TV shows, Law and Order, and House, and CSI. How did that happen? That's very cool, and it's kind of reassuring to know that they're asking, right?
Well, I work only with the writers. I don't work with the producers, directors, and all that stuff. Don't go on set. We're not interested in that. That's a colossal waste of time right there. But I love the writers, and screenwriters seem to have really, really creative minds. It's because they have to get so much done in a short period of time. I kind of like you know, your report that you worked on. You have to condense them down to the meat and the potatoes of the thing and, you know, kind of push everything else aside and let's focus on what we're saying here. And screenwriters have to do that because of the time limitation, 42 minutes or thereabouts for an hour show. It also makes them make a lot of mistakes. But the writers started contacting me, Lee Goldberg, probably has asked me more questions than anybody, to diagnose this murder and all that. But he's a great storyteller, and he asks great questions because he's very knowledgeable and he knows a lot. And I've worked with others, other screenwriters, and I like the way their minds think. And I like the fact that they ask, will this work? Does this make sense? How can
exactly.
I use this?
Very reassuring to know they're asking.
Exactly. Now, whether they use it or not at the end of the day is another issue, but they ask, and yeah, and I like that. You know, you want to be as accurate as possible.
Do you still see patients? I'm sitting here imagining them reading your books and then coming into your office. Your fiction and your forensic books. Do they read them?
Oh, sure.
What do they say?
Sure, and they bring them in for me to sign and stuff like that. Oh, they love it. They love it. I mean, it's you know, they're kind of amazed that their doctor has written books. You know, and somebody actually published them. And I'm kind of amazed too at the end of the day, but. Yeah, you know, they seem to like it, and I haven't met anybody that said, oh, I can't believe you do this.
When did you decide to start making stuff up? You were saying that you decided sort of you couldn't wait till you retired because you know that will never happen, and it's sort of now or never moment. Was there a moment that you thought, oh, I'm going to do this?
Yeah, and I did. I said, okay, you know, if you're going to do this, quit talking about it and just go do it. And how are you going to do it? Well, I read a lot of books on writing, and then, like I said, University of California, Irvine, right here in Orange County, was one of the premier writing programs in the country. You know, T. Jefferson Parker came out of there. It was run by Thomas Keneally, you know, that wrote Schindler's List, ran the program for a while. Before that was Saul Stein, the great writing teacher. So, I mean, they've had some incredible people come through there. Gordon McAlpin, who was one of my early instructors. So I just took a couple of night classes there. I always had to plan them around nights I wasn't on call, so I'd go there for 3 hours once a week and listen to them talk about stuff. And, you know, and then again, you just start writing. You start putting words on a page, and you do a lot of stupid stuff. You write a lot of stuff that you go back and read 15 years later and say, oh, Lord, was I an idiot.
But that's
anything.
Learning. I mean, you went to medical school to learn how to be a doctor. You know, you didn't just start consulting in cardiology.
Well, my very first book. This is, you know, 15 years ago now, and it took me 2.5 years to write. It was 138,000 words of the greatest literature ever written by a human being. I mean, it was perfect in every respect. I sent it to my agent, Kimberly Cameron, who was not my agent then, but we had met at a writer's conference, and I sent it to her, and she called me a week later, and she said, quote, there's a story in here somewhere, I just can't find it. And my response was, thanks, that's what I needed to know. And
that's
the attitude
that's
you have to have. You know,
that's a great bumper sticker. There's a story in here somewhere.
I just can't find it.
I just can't find it. So you look for it, and you carve it out, and then you find the story that you meant to write.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, that book went through 27 rewrites, 4 changes of title, 4 changes of location, and a change of protagonist, and ended up being Stress Fracture, my first film, 12 years later.
When you saw that book for the first time, do you remember that? Did you open the cardboard box and there was Stress Fracture?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I would always pull it out and work on it, but I didn't know enough. I wasn't a good writer. I spent too much time, like we all did, writing about stuff that has nothing to do with the story. But it's kind of
Well, I wonder, do you have a secret cozy or romance under your bed? Was there ever any question that you would write anything but thrillers to you?
No, I like grittier stuff, but I will say this, my next novel is coming out next July from Ocean View. It's called Deep Six, and it's a whole new character, a whole new series, and it's very comedic. I read a lot of Carl Hiaasen and Tim Mulaney and Dorsey growing up. I mean, in the last, you know, growing up, in the last 10 years, I've read a lot of their stuff. And I just love the humor with which they write, and I like humor. I like jokes. So I always wanted to write a humorous thriller. And I said, just do it. So I started, it's the only book I didn't outline, at least until I was halfway through. And I just started writing about this character. and he gets involved in shenanigans that are just totally silly and over the top, but yet it's got a gritty crime and nasty people involved, but it's humorous. And
So this is called Deep Six, correct?
Deep Six.
And it comes out from Ocean View.
It'll be out next July.
I mean, people might be surprised, though they shouldn't be if they know you, that it's funny. What was it like to write humor?
Oh, it was very easy, actually. That's the way I lived my life anyway. My mom was the funniest person on earth. You could laugh at her and every minute of every day. She always had some crazy stuff going on. She turned every minute of every day into a party. That's just the way she was. So I've always enjoyed humor. I've always liked that. You know, I grew up with Jerry Lewis, who's still one of the funniest people to ever walk the face of the earth. I just always liked humor. And to try to marry that with a crime story, I was always, like I said, Carl Hyacin. I read all his stuff, and I was amazed at how he did it. And if you look at Elmore Leonard, one of my favorites, same way. His stuff is funny. It's really funny. It's not funny to the characters, but it's funny to the reader. The way the characters think and the way they do things, and there's a lot of humor in there.
And they're droll and ironic and sarcastic and
right.
sharp. And
all that stuff, yeah.
Who are your favorite authors?
Oh, James Lee Burke and Elmore Leonard by far.
Those are very, I mean, they're both fabulous, of course, but
yes.
One is so fair and one is so luscious.
Exactly, exactly. And they are two ends of the spectrum. And I tell everybody, read everything by those two authors. Every writer should do that and steal all the stuff that works for you. James Lee Burke, I almost cry when I read his stuff. I stop and I read paragraphs again and again because the writing is so poetic. It is so literary. But yet, he writes about down and dirty, nasty crime. And I think that marriage is amazing. Elmore Leonard, on the other hand, writes about a bunch of characters that have no social redeeming value whatsoever. They're all losers and scumbags, but they're so endearing. You love these characters. And, of course, he's the master of dialogue. He writes dialogue when he's not writing dialogue. You know, you can hear the characters talking when it's just
there. You're just in the story. Absolutely.
In
so.
The story.
It must be so much fun for you. You're so active in international thriller writers. To be involved with a group of people who love the same thing you do, and you teach, and you participate, and you're so, you know, you're such a part of the ICW team. How much a part of your life is that?
Oh, it's a lot. I mean, I was one of the charter members of it way back when. You know, we're 11 years old now, and God bless, you know, Gail Lenz and David Morrell for getting this off the dime and getting this organization started. And in the 10 years or 11 years it's existed, it has grown leaps and bounds, leaps and bounds. It's just unbelievable. And, of course,
well, it's a necessary part of it's a necessary part of any mystery or thriller or suspense writer's life.
Yeah, I agree. Everybody should join ICW. There's a lot to offer there, and we keep trying to do more and more. And, of course, Thriller Fest every year keeps getting bigger and better. This year was the best so far. Every July in New York, come on down.
Well, let me just add, now we're getting incredibly meta portion of our interview. Talk about this radio show. You know, usually you're in the interviewer's seat with the amazing
right.
Jan Burke. How did that begin?
Jan put a gun to my head. No, Jan and I go way back, and we've been friends for a long, long time. I just love her to death. She and I have talked about this for years, that we want to do a radio show about forensic science, about people who do this for a living, and an educational thing, but a fun thing. And so a couple of years ago, we sat down over lunch and said, okay, are we going to do this? If we're going to do it, let's just do it. And we agreed, okay, let's do it. Well, now how? I said, well, you know, John Robbie has this great suspense magazine, and suspense radio. Let me talk to him, and maybe he can help us do something. Maybe he wants to produce it for us or whatever. And so as soon as I talked to John, he said, oh, absolutely. This is right up our alley. Perfect. We want to do this. So he made this real easy because we use it through his setup, and he knows all the technical stuff, which Jan and I are pretty much technically challenged. But the show, as you know, is on Blog Talk Radio, and then Suspense Radio, and then we call it Crime and Science Radio. And we've been, this September will be 2 years.
2 years. I mean, it's amazing. It's a very self-assignment, finding just the perfect, more fascinating interviewees, doing the research, asking the questions. What have you learned from doing it on any level?
Oh, so much. Because, again, you get to spend an hour talking to experts. You know, we've had Bill Bass from the Body Farm. We've had Cyril Weck on there, Marcia Clark. We had Linda Fairstein, you know, who basically founded the SDU unit for the NYPD, the sex crimes unit. She's amazing. You name it. We've had, arson experts. We had Barry Fisher, who basically set up the crime lab for LAPD and LA Sheriff's Department up at University of California, Los Angeles. Cal State University, LA, which is where the school is for forensic science, where the crime lab is. I mean, we just have met so many wonderful people. We've had you on there, for goodness sake. You know, we learn all about investigative reporting and what investigative reporters really do. And writers love this stuff, and I think the general public loves this stuff. It's an insider's look.
At real life, though. I mean, one of the things that a doctor sort of has to embrace is that life is precious, you know, and that we just have this one go-round with it. You know, are you surprised at how yours has turned out?
Yeah, actually. It's kind of amazing. But I guess I was raised by parents who said, you know, if you want to do something, you know, don't just sit there and think about it. Just get up and go do it. You know, if you want to learn to play football, you want to learn to play baseball, you want to run a marathon, you want to learn to play the guitar, you want to write books, you know, whatever you want to do, just go do it. It's not like it's hard. You just got to learn. And everything starts with the first step. And that inertia is often the hardest part. You know, example, I mean, going to medical school, it never entered my mind that I couldn't do that. It never entered my mind. So consequently, when I got to medical school, I found there were a whole bunch of people that had been trying for years to get in. And it never crossed my mind. I was so naive that, well, I want to do this, so they're going to let me do it.
And the same with writing?
Same with writing, yeah. I mean, I want to do this, so I'll figure out how to do it. It's not, you know, it's one word. I know words. Yeah. Of course, I read James Lee Burke, and I always think, I know all those words. I just don't know how to put them together.
Exactly.
I didn't learn any words here, but my God, look at this.
Look how that can work.
Exactly.
Stephen King has a great quote. Stephen King has a great quote, which is, the hardest part is just before you start.
Oh, absolutely.
You know, and once you start, and you're on this roller coaster, and you just sort of hang on. I mean, you save people's lives as a doctor. And you've certainly saved authors' lives with your answers, being so accessible and so knowledgeable and so open with this. We're all so grateful to you for this.
Well, I enjoy doing it. Like I said, I learn a lot. I like solving problems and puzzles, and someone presents me with a problem. I have this story problem. I like to think about how best can they solve this issue and use it. So often I'll come up with ideas and I'll suggest it to them. You know, have you thought about this? And I was like, wow, I hadn't thought of it. That would be great. Or, you know, I thought about that, but it doesn't work for my story. Whatever. As long as you thought about it.
Well, I think you must be in more acknowledgments and books than any other living human being. How can people find you? How can they ask you questions?
Well,
and one more time, when does the new book come out?
Well, they can go to my website, which is dplylemd.com. So it's dplylemd.com. And on there, you can find links to how to send a question, to my blog, and to the radio show. You know, all of our shows like this are archived, so you can listen to them forever on the Internet. They're out there. So just go to Crime and Science Radio link, and you can go to past shows and listen to all of them, including Hank, which was a great interview. And the next book is Deep Six, and actually we're doing an update of Forensics for Dummies that will be out in February from Wiley. But the next novel is next July, and it's called Deep Six, and it's from Ocean View.
And we're so looking forward to that. Thank you so much for being on your very own radio show, Doug Lyle, the Answer Man.
Thank you for asking me. It's been great.